Chapter 8. Thinking and Acting. Imagine that you learned your government is about to start annihilating all people with red hair, or all people in a certain city, or all people with skin either lighter or darker than a certain shade, or all people who profess one common religion or another. Would you be incredulous? Could you even make sense of such news? The people of many, though not all countries, would simply not believe it. But imagine you became convinced it is true. You would still be incredulous. Why would they do it, you might ask? Why would your government seek to slaughter 10,000, 100,000, 1,000,000, or 6,000,000 people? Why butcher children by the thousands? For what reason? None of the rationales make sense because they violate what you know about your political system and its leaders, your society, and your fellow citizens. A notable feature of eliminationist onslaughts is how easily the perpetrators and the wider population from which they come understand what is being done and why. In exterminationist and eliminationist assaults' voluminous history, we find few instances of perpetrators or members of their social and political groups greeting the news of an impending or actual annihilation or elimination with incredulity, either born of a failure to comprehend its rationale or a belief in the deed's unequivocal monstrousness. This absence of incomprehension is striking, and undoubtedly to many listeners startling, given the countries they live in. That perpetrators and their groups and societies immediately comprehend the eliminationist and annihilationist program as reasonable is explicable if the people are already prepared to find these eliminationist measures comprehensible, even desirable. In virtually all cases, this has been so, as powerful discourses have readied the societies and people to consider the targeted groups noxious and dangerous. A partial exception was the Soviet Union during the terror that, resulting from Joseph Stalin's paranoia, was often arbitrary. Stalin turned on his party, loyal followers, and military's officer corps. Such socially shared beliefs remain just that, socially shared beliefs that are, whether partly submerged or publicly prominent, not accompanied by physical attacks until the right moment arrives. Then, quickly, people understand that action previously deemed unimaginable, improbable, or impractical is now a permissible option. This occurs with many kinds of political opportunities, including when eliminating another sort of enemy, a hated and repressive political regime, suddenly becomes possible. Czechoslovakia's President Václav Havel, during his 1990 New Year's Day address, not long after the Velvet Revolution brought down communism, asked, "How is it possible that so many people understood what to do and that none of them needed any advice or instructions?" His rhetorical question applies equally to the perpetrators and social groups that implement and support one eliminationist onslaught after another. In the former Yugoslavia's various eliminationist assaults, rival ethnic communities, including the potential perpetrators among them, discussed and understood the putative demonic pasts of targeted groups and the necessity of eliminating them. Serbs referred to Bosnian Muslims as Turks, Christian Europe's Muslim invaders, and the Serbs' century-long enemies. Serbs called Croats Ustasha, the fascists during the Nazi period who slaughtered Serbs. And Croats faced off against Serbian Chetniks, Serb paramilitaries during World War II. Not in the former Yugoslavia and almost never elsewhere do we find evidence that the perpetrators or the broader population were surprised by their leaders' radical and lethal policies, or that they failed to understand the underlying motive grounded in an eliminationist conception of the victims. Some among the populations from which the perpetrators come may dissent from the majority's view of the victims, morally oppose the measures, or deplore the eliminationist methods, particularly an annihilative onslaught's licentiousness. But overwhelmingly, shared understanding of and agreement with the eliminationist program has predated the actual assaults. How does this come about? Not through peer pressure. Not through blind obedience to authority, not because modernity has transformed people into bureaucrats, and not due to any other reductionist notion that has been posited in defiance of the historical record. It comes about through language and visual images as the bearers of cultural notions, including how to understand humanity and, in particular, other disparaged peoples and groups. Of the five factors crucially contributing to our era's exterminationist and eliminationist projects, initiation and character, three, the modern state's enormous transformative power, structural conflicts existing within states, and permissive international contexts, are structural factors that have systematically given impetus to political leaders to conceive of and act upon eliminationist aspirations. A fourth factor, the opportunity or immediate political context that makes it practical for political leaders to act on eliminationist desires, is contingent. The fifth feature, the beliefs that lead people to think it necessary to eliminate others, is, though common, not a systemic property of our time. Because the presence and content of such beliefs are highly variable, exploring them and the means for their widespread dissemination is critically important. Discourse and the dissemination of eliminationist beliefs. Language is the principal medium for preparing people to support or perpetrate mass murder and elimination, because it is the vehicle for conceptualizing, conveying, and making persuasive the necessary prejudices and ideas. Visual images, such as caricature, often reinforce the prejudices and ideas, and powerfully, sometimes more powerfully than language itself, encapsulate them in indelibly memorable forms. Personal experience is not what leads people to believe that those they target are noxious or dangerous, subhuman or demonic. How could it? The targeted people are overwhelmingly strangers, numbering in the tens of thousands or millions. Language's elaborated notions, dire constructs, labeling, caricature, and reductionist and fear-inspiring stories teach people prejudices about entire groups of disparaged, despised, or feared people, and the necessity or logic of eliminationist solutions. The December 1993 issue of Kangura is ironically titled, Tutsi, Race of God, with the vertical words revealing what the Tutsi really are and the severity of their threat. What weapons will we use to win over the Inyenzi, cockroaches, for good? The eliminationist answer imminent in the discourse's logic can be seen in the image of a machete, which together with the anti-Tutsi leader of Rwanda in 1959, tell Hutu all they need to know about what should be and is in the offing. Ingarambi recounts the common things Hutu believed about Tutsi, which made this newspaper cover both unremarkable and immediately comprehensible, as he discusses what they called Tutsi while they raped and killed Tutsi women. First, Tutsi are snakes. Tutsi are an enemy. Tutsi are cruel, to disrespect them. Or, Inkotanyi, they have tails. So many things to make them lose their true colors. They are anti-Rwanda, against the country, anti-survivor, cockroach, snakes. A snake is very bad and it means something. Even the Bible says that snake means something bad, evil. It was to humiliate them. They had no value. So the Hutu killed them. Language and visual images conveyed in talk and discussion, newspapers, magazines, and books, and radio, television, and today the internet, give life to and spread notions that entire groups of people are vermin, are inherently treacherous, have the appetites, moral sense, or intellectual capacity of lower primates, pose danger, covet your house, wife, or land, seek your and your kind's destruction, and willfully and obstinately block human or divine prosperity or progress. Herero are baboons and swine. Jews are bacilli or rats or Bolsheviks or devils. Poles are subhumans. Kikuyu are vermin, animals, and barbarians. Bangladeshis are devils. Putatively impure Khmer are diseased elements. Maya are animals, pigs, and dogs. Tutsi are cockroaches, dogs, snakes, or zeros. Indonesian communists are infidels, as are Americans and many others. Darfurians are slaves. Metaphors of disease, infestations, predatory or dangerous animals, criminality, subhumanity, and malevolent supernatural beings abound. Such notions are first propagated linguistically and visually, then similarly conveyed to others, taught to new generations, further spread or intensified by political leaders and regimes. Although identifiable sociological or political factors, and occasionally cynical political leaders, may generate such notions, once they consolidate into socially shared prejudice, particularly when reinforced in political practice, they are strongly self-validating and reproducing, becoming the common sense wisdom of their societies, groups, or cultures, or subcultures, circulating socially among ordinary people and from parent to child, and then among the children themselves. Any study of mass murder and elimination that fails to give primacy to language and imagery as their generative medium and to the specific beliefs that people, through language, relate to one another and thereby reinforce, denies the fundamental reality of how people, whether leaders or followers, become cognitively, to a large extent psychologically, and emotionally prepared to give themselves to the violent elimination of others, and how people become mobilized to attack, dragoon, expel, or kill others. Language, demeaning, expressing hate, or inspiring fear about others, often coalesces into a stable, patterned set of beliefs, tropes, symbols, and charges, often called a discourse, but more properly called, because it conveys its social reality, a conversation. Different societies, ethnic groups, political parties, and political leaders and their followers have explicit symbol-laden and encoded conversations about other people or groups they deem noxious or perceive as threatening. These conversations can resemble acquaintances' ongoing, years-long, multi-stranded discussions, sometimes impassioned and sometimes casual, that pick up where they left off and take off in new directions, repeating and returning to well-known themes even as they incorporate new notions and develop new arguments with unfolding events, resonating powerfully to those familiar with them as they listen attentively or as background music to the familiar tropes, while perhaps sounding striking to newcomers seeking to understand and assimilate their terms. In Rwanda, a powerful Hutu eliminationist discussion of the Tutsi was already long established when the quasi-governmental radio station Radio Télévision Libre des Mille Collines, RTLM, became its new focal point in August 1993. Vianney Higiro, the director of the government's official station, Radio Rwanda, explains in these striking terms. These broadcasts were like a conversation among Rwandans who knew each other well and were relaxing over some banana beer or a bottle of Primus, the local beer, in a bar. It was a conversation without a moderator and without any requirements as to the truth of what was said. The people who were there recounted what they had seen or heard during the day. The exchanges covered everything, rumors circulating on the hills, news from the national radio, conflicts among local political bosses. It was all in fun. Some people left the bar, others came in. The conversation went on or stopped if it got too late, and the next day it took up again after work. Leading up to the government's initiation of the mass murder, radio stations and other media reinforced Hutu's prejudicial views and deep suspicions of Tutsi and further prepared them for the coming assault. During the exterminationist assault, radio became the principal source of Hutu's understanding of unfolding events, forcefully exhorting ordinary Hutu to annihilate the Tutsi enemy. Augustine Bazimaziki, one of the Hutu killers, explains that the killing began with the radio broadcasting some news such as, "We need to kill all the Tutsi." And then, as they were mercilessly hunting them down, the radio broadcasted the information such that we need to kill Tutsi 7 days a week. Joseph Désiré Bitero, one of the Nyamata region's and Rwanda's leading perpetrators, suggests how such a discourse can powerfully imbue people with an eliminationist mindset, even while they live side by side with those they will eventually attack. "I was born surrounded by Tutsi in Kanazi. I always had Tutsi acquaintances and thought nothing of it. Still, I did grow up listening to history lessons and radio programs that were always talking about major problems between Hutu and Tutsi, though I lived among Tutsi who posed no problem. The situation was going to pieces due to the impossible gap between the worrisome news about the mess on the country's borders and the peaceful people who lived next door. The situation was bound to come apart and go into either savagery or neighborliness." Hence the paradox found in many societies that mass murderously erupt, of an edifice of relatively good local relations among neighbors from different groups existing upon a rotting, tottering foundation of prejudices, hatred, and suspicion that, when activated politically, engulfs all members of the other group, including those neighbors. Even if not literally correct for all mass murders and eliminations, when Bitero says, "You will never see the source of a genocide," he expresses an essential truth about the difficulty of discerning the volcanic destructiveness embedded in something as seemingly innocuous as words, and to see the cause and effect relationship between the two, which is why so many who write about genocide do not see or are unwilling to believe the source of a genocide. Bitero explains, "It is buried too deep in grudges, under an accumulation of misunderstandings that we were the last to inherit. We came of age at the worst moment in Rwanda's history. We were taught to obey absolutely, raised in hatred, stuffed with slogans. We must understand more about these socially shared grudges, accumulated misunderstandings, hatred, and slogans, and about the eliminationist conversations they and other elements compose, including the explicit beliefs and images and the underlying cultural models about the targeted groups they construct, the logic for action they contain, and the relationship of different conversational stages to taking action against human targets." Such discourses often individually deserve substantial, even book-length, treatment to be adequately represented and fully analyzed. Nevertheless, a common core of issues tells us a great deal about these discourses' essence and allows us to analyze them comparatively and to understand them as springboards to action. How these discourses present potential or intended victims offers insight into mass elimination's patterns and features. Eliminationist discourses have relatively stable constructions or descriptions of the targeted groups, which include explicit, easily graspable accounts of the group's putative noxiousness, including coherent charges, manifest or implied, about their threat and at least implications of how to meet it. All prejudicial and eliminationist discourses contain a widespread, underlying cognitive model of the disparaged people that provides a foundation and general structure to the discourse's more elaborated narratives, accounts, and characterizations of them. Three dimensions structure the models underlying such discourses. Groups and individuals with antipathies, antagonisms, or animus toward another group have a notion of how pernicious and therefore dangerous the group is or can be. They have some understanding of the source of that group's perniciousness, whether their biology, their culture, including religion, or changeable environmental conditions, such as education, social opportunities, and discrimination. These two dimensions, putative perniciousness and its source, together provide an understanding of the disparaged group's putative threat, what might contain, forfend, or diffuse it, and that group's transformability in the short or long term. The third dimension of latent to manifest tells us how central these notions are at a given moment to those holding them, and clarifies how prejudices, hatreds, desires for vengeance, and other beliefs and emotions that suggest eliminationist action can simmer beneath the surface relatively harmlessly, and then be quickly activated into violent, destructive, murderous action. An index of imputed group perniciousness and danger could be constructed for any and every group believed to harbor noxious qualities. As intergroup prejudice is commonplace and varies enormously, we would find a wide array of perniciousness scores, including low ones between Northern and Southern Italians, Prussians and Bavarians, Flemish and Walloons, Americans and Canadians, among Germans, French, Italians, and British for one another, among Danes, Swedes, and Norwegians for one another, and so on, or between German Catholics and Protestants, or Social Democrats and Christian Democrats, or their counterparts in one European country after another. Many members of these national, regional, ethnic, religious, and political groups have antipathies or antagonisms for the other domestic or foreign groups, conceiving them to have unpleasant, noxious, or pernicious qualities, which may be moral, dispositional, or aspirational, and therefore to pose a challenge to the first group's well-being or aspirations. Analyzing mild prejudices and antipathies and real group differences and conflicts in this way helps us understand that all such group differences can be scored for imputed perniciousness and danger. The noxious qualities imputed by British to French, German Social Democrats to Christian Democrats, Flemish to Walloons, or Swedes and Danes to one another, do not remotely suggest to their bearers that an eliminationist solution is necessary. These low-level prejudices do not come close to suggesting the degree of perniciousness eliminationist and exterminationist thinking requires as a foundation. Such variation in different prejudices' perniciousness reveals how misguided is the commonplace discussion, in the literatures on genocide and many other themes, of people's construction of groups as an other. Hundreds, thousands, millions, and billions of others exist, depending on whether we are discussing nationalities, coalesced groups, genders, or individuals. Every person is an other for every other person. Whoever identifies himself particularistically with one or more groups, as everyone does, or with those sharing some aspect of his or her identity, always defines those groups and people not falling into that particularistic universe as an other. Constructing others and having them constructed for you is inherent to human existence. Thus, the other is hardly a master category for illuminating eliminationist assaults, and the construction of others is effectively irrelevant for understanding or explaining such assaults, or just about anything else in social and political life. The issue is, rather, the kinds of others constructed by or for you as a member of a political movement, society, or culture or subculture, and how you conceive of them, including here especially their putative, noxious qualities. It is not the undifferentiated notion of the ubiquitous other, but the hostile and prejudicial beliefs and emotions one group's members have for another group that must be explored. And these beliefs can, as we see, be analyzed according to their sources and degrees of perniciousness. If we take an instance of more intense prejudice in the United States among whites against blacks, it varies from non-existent to garden-variety prejudices and antipathies to more substantial conceptions of blacks' perniciousness. Whatever prejudice's current levels, they have been declining for half a century, an eliminationist initiative against blacks would not even occur to whites. That is, except among white supremacists with a quasi-Nazi-like racist worldview, accusing, even prior to Barack Obama's becoming president, blacks, Jews, and others of capturing the American government and of working to subjugate and destroy Aryans or whites. Jews are not considered white. The Turner Diaries, a fictional diary of a white supremacist depicting a race war and perhaps the white supremacist movement's most widely read book, tells of blacks exerting an increasingly degenerative influence on the culture and lifestyles of the inhabitants of North America. Because white supremacists' prejudices and political ideology are Nazi-like, their accounts and hatred of Jews sometimes comes straight from Nazi writings, they fantasize about, discuss, and plan for an eliminationist assault against those they believe are destroying whiteness, Christianity, and goodness. The Turner Diaries explicitly discusses the danger to the white race as so extreme that to quell it, even innocents must perish. But there is no way we can destroy the system without hurting many thousands of innocent people. No way. It is a cancer too deeply rooted in our flesh, and if we don't destroy the system before it destroys us, if we don't cut this cancer out of our living flesh, our whole race will die. Timothy McVeigh, the mass murderer who, in bombing the Oklahoma City Federal Building in April 1995, killed 168 people, with the injured the casualties totaled more than 1,000, was a devotee of the Turner Diaries, in which such a bombing occurs. A few days before his attack, he sent excerpts from it to his sister. He bought a copy on the trip to Oklahoma City to perpetrate his atrocity against the alleged Zionist occupation government of the United States outpost there. We can distinguish, as we see for the degrees of perniciousness that American whites attribute to blacks, two fundamentally different conceptions of groups. One is of sufficient perniciousness to include an eliminationist logic suggesting or implying an eliminationist solution. The other is of far less perniciousness, not suggesting eliminationist thinking or acting. Some conceptions of groups occupy the border zone between the two, and because beliefs are somewhat fluid with changing contexts and circumstances, they may move from one side to the other. Most prejudices and hatreds, however, fall clearly on one side or the other of the eliminationist-non-eliminationist line. We can leave behind the enormous number of people's conceptions of groups that are not eliminationist to plumb the character and differences of those that have led to exterminationist and eliminationist assaults. Keeping in mind these discourses contain conceptions of the source of groups' perniciousness, we need to think further about the two principal ways they construct an understanding of the hated or feared group: dehumanization and demonization. Whether and how perpetrators dehumanize or demonize people matters enormously because it, together with the perpetrator's broader social and moral theories, informs their eliminationist treatment of them. Dehumanization and demonization. The term dehumanization is rightly a commonplace of discussions of mass murder. It is used as a master category that describes the attitudes of killers, would-be killers, and larger groups toward actual or intended victims. But as used, it serves to homogenize different kinds of beliefs, preventing further in-depth and comparative analysis, and most critically, to variously elide or conceal two separate conceptual dimensions. A belief, really an assemblage of beliefs, exists that can properly be said to constitute the dehumanizing of others. It is that other people inherently lack qualities fundamental to being fully human in the sense of deserving moral respect, rights, and protection. Such beings are said to lack human capacities or powers and, as a definitional matter, do not need to be treated as humans. European colonizers believed this about the peoples of Africa, Asia, and the Americas. A second belief, also complex and various, is the demonization of others. This belief is about other people's moral quality, including their moral intentions. It holds the people to be, literally or figuratively, demonic, morally evil. This view can be grounded in a religious or quasi-religious sense that the devil or other malevolent supernatural beings inhabit or control or are such people. Classic instances of demonization are medieval and early modern Europe's and New England's witch crazes, during which tens of thousands of people, mostly women, were accused of being possessed and demonic. Nevertheless, such beliefs usually have nothing to do with religion or the supernatural, but are grounded in the view that people are of such evil nature and intentions, they might as well be devils or possessed by one. Though many hated and disparaged groups are neither dehumanized nor demonized, those that are can be so in different ways and to varying degrees, so each dimension is a continuum with a range of values. The dimension of dehumanization is mainly about biological, cognitive, physical, etc., capacity held to be impaired. The dimension of demonization is mainly about moral character, held to be depraved or so debased the people might as well be depraved. Dehumanization and demonization do not necessarily go hand in hand. The dehumanized are not also always demonized. Whites enslaving blacks in the American South, and later repressing them with Jim Crow, dehumanized them, deeming them subhumans of diminished intellectual and moral capabilities, akin to domesticated semi-wild animals that, when kept in check, were useful, but if loose, could be dangerous. Whites did not construe their slaves or freed blacks as malevolent demons bent upon harming them. Imperialist Europeans held similar attitudes toward Asian, African, and American peoples. The Nazis and many Germans dehumanized the mentally ill and developmentally disabled. Karl Binding, the former president of Germany's Supreme Court, together with psychiatry professor Alfred Hoch, in a 1920 book that created a sensation, Permission for the Destruction of Worthless Life, Its Extent and Form, asked rhetorically, giving an affirmative answer, "Are there humans who have lost their human characteristics to such an extent that their continued existence has lost all value both for themselves and for society?" These people, including those described as incurable lunatics, were not evil, but in not possessing human characteristics were completely worthless. Similarly, Japanese, at least until World War II's end, dehumanized other Asians without demonizing them. Takeuchi Yoshimi, an eminent Japanese scholar and translator of Chinese literature, explained in 1978 that before the war, when we studied Chinese history and geography, we never studied the fact that there were humans there. The Japanese's racist belief in other Asians' lesser human status allowed the Japanese to enslave and kill them at will. But they did not conceive of their victims as demonic in their moral values and intentions. Inferior, yes. Enemies, yes. Dangerous, yes. It was part of the natural order of human enmity and threat, of the logic of power and conquer or be conquered. Similarly, not all those demonized are also dehumanized. When asked, Rithi Yong, having spent 4 years under the Khmer Rouge and coming into contact with an enormous number of them, affirmed that they saw the new people as human beings, but also they saw us as an enemy also. They wouldn't trust us. They just see us as different kind of person, new people. They believe that brought nothing except trouble to them. Many mass-murdering communists demonized their enemies without dehumanizing them, holding them as bearers of antagonistic class interests or agents of malevolent capitalism, to be in the grip of interests or ideologies making them dangerous. But they did not deem them to lack fundamental human attributes. Communist leaders, while killing millions, chose not to kill a much greater number opposing them because, informed by Marxism, they believed people are corrigible and set out to reform them, including sometimes in gulags from which they eventually released many. Some communist leaders, especially in Central Europe, secure in power because of Soviet backing, and sometimes, as in Poland and Czechoslovakia, because they were less ardent Marxists, did not mass murder their own peoples. During the Cold War, neither the Soviet leaders nor the rank and file believed Americans or Western Europeans were less than human, but they did demonize the West's so-called ruling classes as morally corrupt, venal, and seeking to exploit humanity. Conversely, some people, most catastrophically Indonesians, demonized the communists among them, believing that to parry their diabolical challenge, they had to eliminate them as a political entity, killing many and compelling so many more to de-demonize themselves by imbibing the prescribed antidote, religious conversion. In general, when facing radical or revolutionary challenges to the socio-economic and political order, establishments tend to demonize such challengers, sometimes reacting in murderous fury. In many Latin American countries during the 1970s and 1980s, those in power on the political right killed many more in their counterinsurgency campaigns than the rebellious left ever killed. Today, Al-Qaeda and other political Islamists demonize infidels, especially those they deem their enemies. But they do not dehumanize them, because all infidels must do to be redeemed is accept Allah, and their danger passes. The imputed capacity of rehabilitation or redemption is the critical issue for analyzing whether people are dehumanizing, demeaned, hated, or feared others. Do they believe the others, at least in principle, can be reformed? The dehumanized, putatively bereft of fundamental human attributes owing to their biology, cannot be reformed, re-educated, civilized, transformed through any process into full human beings. In many instances, the source of their dehumanized condition is conceived of in racist terms, deriving from their ethnicity, blood, or race, or genes, biological givens and therefore unchangeable. Their children, by dint of their biology, inherit their putatively debased nature, so they too are automatically dehumanized. To be sure, some dehumanized people are thought of in seemingly contradictory ways as less than human and capable as individuals of becoming civilized, and as a collectivity of being reformed, but usually only over the long run. Such was the attitude of some British colonizers in India, though by no means everywhere else. This kind of dehumanization, having as its source a cultural theory of the group's nature, is comparatively rare. Cultural theories, unless they also demonize, do not dehumanize people as much because the condition is not seen as permanent and gradations of human capacities are recognized. A simple matrix containing groups that our age's most omnivorous killers, the Nazis, murdered, illustrates the separate dimensions of dehumanization and demonization, and also how the same perpetrators conceive of victim groups differently along these dimensions. An example of people who are neither dehumanized nor demonized would include enemy hostages. Examples of those who are not dehumanized but are demonized include German communists and gay men. Slavs, the mentally ill, the Sinti, and the Roma are all examples of groups of people that have been dehumanized but have not been demonized. Lastly, an example of people who are both dehumanized and demonized would include Jews in Nazi Germany. The Nazis codified their racist understanding of humanity in a formal pseudo-scientific race theory, which they made the German educational system's foundational and unifying theme. This theory defined races according to cranium type, facial features, coloring, height, and other physical features, which also divided the peoples conventionally called white or of European descent into various qualitatively distinct races. The Nazis saw different nationalities and ethnic groups as biologically distinct races arrayed on a continuum of human mental capacity and commensurate moral worth. Nordic or Aryan peoples stood at the pinnacle. Slavic peoples stooped below as subhumans, black Africans still further below, hunched down on the cusp between humanity and other primates. A pamphlet titled The Subhuman, of which the Germans published almost 4 million copies in German and translated into 14 other languages, spells out the historically common, though rarely so clearly articulated, view of dehumanized people. The subhuman, that biologically, seemingly complete, similar creation of nature, with hands, feet, and a kind of brain, with eyes and a mouth, is nevertheless a completely different, dreadful creature. He is only a rough copy of a human being, with human-like facial traits, but nonetheless morally and mentally lower than any animal. Within this creature there is a fearful chaos of wild, uninhibited passions, nameless destructiveness, the most primitive desires, the nakedest vulgarity. Subhuman, otherwise nothing. For all that bear a human face are not equal. Woe to him who forgets it. For Nazis, the Slavic peoples were not more evil or demonic than a gorilla, but, like gorillas, were inherently amoral and dangerous, and thus to be kept in check. Slavs were lower beings, fit to be beasts of burden, used as slaves or killed depending on the Germans' needs. Because the Germans viewed the Slavic peoples as numerous beyond the German Empire's needs, Germans readily killed millions and would have eliminated and killed tens of millions more had they won the war. Similarly, people who were mentally ill, developmentally disabled, or with congenital diseases were dehumanized as individuals, deemed bereft of fundamental human attributes, lives unworthy of life, in the Nazi argot, useless eaters, a drag on Germany's economic and biological stock. So they could be and were killed. Many Germans responded to this aspect of the Nazis' mass murderousness with horror. The regime was killing Germans' own relatives and community members, and protested with some effect. Yet those Germans who had most internalized the regnant biological determinism, and this included the physicians and nurses murdering these people, considered killing them a praiseworthy act serving the German people's health. In contrast to these dehumanized groups and individuals, the Nazis demonized political opponents, particularly communists. In the Nazi worldview, the virus of communism, an allegedly Jewish invention, had infected these people, despite their good racial stock, transforming them into demonic enemies bent upon wreaking havoc in Germany, weakening and decimating the German people, and delivering Germany to Bolshevik Russia. Within Germany, the Nazis incarcerated and killed the communist and socialist leadership, but they allowed the rank-and-file communists, seen as relatively easily deprogrammable, to continue living in German society. Because the source of the communists' threat was not biological, the Nazis did not need a biological solution. Communist people were not subhuman, so once German communists abandoned their communist practices, the Nazis treated them as good Germans. Ex-communist Roland Friesler rose to be chief of the regime's People's Court, presiding over the country's show trials of those who resisted the regime. The Nazis had other enemies, including the French, whom they neither dehumanized nor demonized, but saw as old-fashioned enemies to be defeated and controlled brutally. Applying the logic of morally unrestrained warfare, they murdered French by the hundreds after suffering sabotage or other attacks as retribution and deterrent. The Nazis' fantastical ideological view of the Jews construed them as Germany's most dangerous enemy. The Jews' unusual place, even among the Nazis' long list of enemy and hated groups, was such that the Nazis and Germans in general considered the Jews to be a breed apart, less than human, indeed not even human, and demonic, powerfully malevolent to the core. Kurt Mobius, serving in the Chełmno death camp, explained his thinking, the norm among Germans, about the orders to annihilate the Jews. It did not at all occur to me that these orders could be unjust. It made sense to him. He, like his countrymen, had been prepared for the exterminationist assault by German society's powerful eliminationist discourse. I was then of the conviction that the Jews were not innocent but guilty. I believed the propaganda that all Jews were criminals and subhumans, and that they were the cause of Germany's decline after the First World War. The thought that one should disobey or evade the order to participate in the extermination of the Jews did not therefore enter my mind at all. In addition to this man's clear explanation of how he was prepared to exterminate all Jews because of what he already believed about them long before he received the killing order, he also succinctly captures and conveys both the dehumanized and demonized view of the Jews that was then Germans' common sense. All Jews were criminals, in other words, demonized, and all Jews were subhumans, in other words, dehumanized. According to the Nazis and ordinary Germans alike, Jews were racially, genetically programmed to undermine, enslave, even destroy humanity, especially its most exalted people, the Germans. They were, in a common formulation Heinrich Himmler employed at a 1938 conference of SS generals, the primordial matter of everything negative. Adolf Hitler attributed to them unparalleled cosmic malevolence and apocalyptic power, warning all Germans in Mein Kampf, his candid guide to his worldview and political thinking, of the consequences of a victorious Jewry. And as, in this greatest of all recognizable organisms, the result of an application of such a law could only be chaos, on Earth it could only be destruction for the inhabitants of this planet. If, with the help of his Marxist creed, the Jew is victorious over the other peoples of the world, his crown will be the funeral wreath of humanity, and this planet will, as it did millions of years ago, move through the ether devoid of men. Nowhere else in prejudice's annals, certainly in modern times, except against Jews, have people, let alone political leaders, conceived of groups in such cosmologically evil terms. For Germans and other similar European racist anti-Semites, the continuum of human races did not include the Jews, conceived of as an anti-race, the Antichrist's human equivalent, to be not of diminished intellectual and moral capacity, as subhumans almost always are conceived, but highly capable and depraved, dangerous and determined, a threat that would never end. Before expanding the discussion of dehumanization and demonization beyond Germany during the Nazi period, we need to recognize that not every demeaned, hated, or feared group can be so easily classified. As with most belief systems, a diversity of views often exists among the people who despise others. Also, whether people initially dehumanize or demonize others, their prejudicial conception sometimes leads them to respond to new developments by grafting the other prejudicial conception onto it. Thus, those dehumanizing others sometimes begin to believe that the putative subhumans are vulnerable to demonic powers or ideologies, such as communism. Similarly, those demonizing an ethnic group can tend to dehumanize it as well, to see the demonic qualities as residing in the group's biology. Aside from such complexity, the prejudiced and haters are not scholars concerned with category boundaries and expressive clarity, so discerning their views' real basis can be challenging. Finally, the two dimensions do not capture everything relevant to categorizing prejudice and hatred, which are each internally complex. Two kinds of examples bring out this general complexity.